Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome to Nightlight, everybody. So glad you could join us. We have an interesting show tonight, but first I want to thank Ken Quiet Hawk for that amazing intro. Please seek him out on the internet. Just Google Native Storytellers and you will find him most probably at the top of the list. He is an amazing man. His journey is phenomenal. And the stories that he tells not only entertain but enlighten and give you another look at a different way of preserving cosmology and history. That said, I have a special guest tonight, and this is a subject and a topic that's near and dear to me because I can sort of relate, but not totally, but sort of relate to him. Stephen LaPlume is my guest, and he's written a book entitled Rendlesham to Redemption, A Story of Transformation. It's a book about one man's journey of not only the sighting of an unmanned aerial craft, but also the life-changing trauma that followed. It's not just a UFO story. It's a story of overcoming life's tragedies and traumas and never giving up hope for a better tomorrow. Steve LaPlume was an airman first class during the famous Rendlesham Forest incident in Suffolk, England. After this life-changing event, he went on to become a professional soldier for hire, a bodyguard, and eventually changed his life and became a husband and father. He worked in the petrochemical industry and construction management. In 2003, he moved to China, where he manufactured motorcycle equipment as well as raced superbike motorcycles and continued working as a bodyguard. He's back in the U.S. now. And I'm so glad he's with us tonight because it's always a joy to talk to somebody else who has been through the same type of experience that I went through a long time ago as well. He went through his experience 40 years ago. Mine was 55. And sighting a UFO changes somebody. It isn't just the shock of seeing something that you can't explain. It's what it does to your consciousness, and it's how it shifts the way you look at life and the way you apply yourself to life. And his book is an amazing chronicle of his journey. It sends everyone who sees a UFO, it sends them on a journey of seeking, and everybody seeks differently. So I am so glad that he is able to be with us tonight because it's nice to know that somebody else went through the same thing that I did so very long ago, and it still is affecting the consciousness and the life. So welcome to the show, Steve. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the invite.
Well, I my sighting wasn't as famous as yours, but let's get over the fact that you were at the Air Force Base in England in December of 1980.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's when.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Everybody has sort of heard the story of Rendlesham Forest incident. You were actually there. So just if you can, tell us what you saw first off, and then what your reaction to was after you saw it.
Okay, but first I need to clear up that I was not at the sighting in December of 1980.
Okay.
I was on base at that time, and I was aware of what was going on. And my actual sighting was January, right around the 28th of 1981. So it was about a month after the big RFI incident.
Okay.
So, all right. So, and when that incident happened, it got swept under the rug so quick. It was just, all we heard was a couple of guys got chased by a UFO, and we really didn't hear much more than that. You know, like I said, it was just hushed up real quick, and that was that. So a month later, I didn't really have a clue as to what we now know what happened during those couple of nights. Again, all I heard was these three guys got chased out in the forest by a UFO. Yeah, okay, whatever. You know, it's just,
yeah.
All right. You know? So, but a month later, I was out there at the East Gate, and I was there with my partner, and he was actually my supervisor, and witnessed a craft in the sky. We were just checking the back gate to make sure it was secure, and we saw, you know, it just looked like a satellite in the sky, you know, if you've ever seen a satellite moving along. It was just a bright light. But then it started doing some really weird gyrations up and down, kind of like a heartbeat monitor is the only way I can describe it. And it was way up in the sky. I mean, it was, like I said, it was satellite distance. It was nothing you could discern what it was other than a ball of light. And but what it was doing was crazy. I mean, there's no craft I've ever seen that could do something like that. So we called it in eventually, and boy, all hell broke loose. We had officers everywhere coming out and questioning us what was going on. They went out into the forest, which really confused me because I didn't understand why they were going out into the forest. Because our last sighting was, it was over the forest, but I mean, it was at, you know, 30, 40,000 feet. I don't know, it was way up in the sky. So, again, not knowing what happened those other nights, it was confusing as to why they would have just gotten a car and gone out to the forest. But but they came back about 30, 40 minutes later, said they didn't see anything, and they posted me on that gate the rest of the night. And that is, officially, that was the end of my sighting. However, when my supervisor came back about an hour later, we sat around talking about, wow, that was kind of weird, huh? What was that all about?
Yeah.
And while we were talking, we saw a plane, what we figured might have been a plane, a light coming in from the North Sea area, and that's typically the approach that a craft would make to land at the, you know, at the base there at Woodbridge. And but it was a little to the right of where it should have been as far as the approach path for the runway. And all of a sudden I realized, wow, this is not a plane coming in for a landing. It was like a light that was coming over the treetop level of the forest, and it came right up the access road. There was like a main road and then this little access road to get up to the gate. And it came up that road and eventually was over our heads, and I was standing there with my head bent backwards, craning my neck, looking at the bottom of this ship that made no sound. And I had no senses either. I had no hearing whatsoever. I don't remember hearing anything. If Palmer had been talking, you know, if my partner had been talking, I hadn't heard a word he said, anything. I was just sitting there looking at it. And honestly, I remember looking up initially and just going, wow, suck it up, Steve. This is going to be the greatest thing you ever saw. You're looking at a UFO. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, it was a structured craft, you know, and eventually after, about 15, 20 seconds or so, maybe a little more than that, it eventually took off and slowly made its way. I mean, I use the word meandering. Yeah, meandering.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of meandered the sky real slow, and then eventually became a star. You know, it was the same size and shape and twinkle of a star. And I couldn't tell the craft from a star, and it was gone, and that was that. So my partner said, "Well, do you want to call that in?" And I just looked at him and said, "Help." And we never talked about it again. Oddly enough, we didn't talk about it that night, the next day, never, ever did we ever talk about it again. We never compared notes. What did you see? What do you think? Nothing. And he just went, okay. He said, "Well, you know, keep an eye on things." And he went about his business and I went about mine and stayed at that gate the rest of the night. But we never called that in, so it was never officially recorded. And that individual went on to work with the Air Force OSI, so I'm sure he wants nothing to do with this case.
And, how old were you then?
I had just turned 18.
Oh,
yeah,
goodness.
I actually went in the – I was 17 when I went in the service. I had to get my parents to sign for me. So, yeah, I had just turned 18 in July, so I was 18 and a half years old. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, from what you said in your book, at that time, you fit in. You were very comfortable with your place in the service. You were, this is it, the structure, the whole thing fits me.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Yeah, I enjoyed the service. You know, it was nice and regimented. I knew what I was doing every day, what my shift was, what my job was, and that's fine. And I was kind of in between. I didn't have my security clearance yet, so I couldn't work with the security personnel, which what I was trained to do. So that's why I was at Woodbridge on law enforcement. I was temporarily assigned to them because they were shorthanded and I had no security clearance. What were they going to do with me? So they just pawned me off on the law enforcement, which was fine. And I realized real quick I was kind of a redheaded stepchild. I didn't fit in anywhere. I wasn't qualified with a pistol. I wasn't qualified to be a police officer. So all I was really relegated to doing was giving people bathroom breaks and chow hall breaks and, you know, working the worst gates. And yeah, but I didn't mind it because I think, well, sooner or later I'll get my clearance and I'll go back to working with security and everything will be fine, you know. And I very comfortable. The Air Force had taken care of me, given me the country I wanted that I requested. I was a pretty happy camper before that day. So now I was homesick, I will say.
But after this incident, there was a change in you. And that's something that happens to most people. And you know, it was like, what happened? What happened inside of you that suddenly turned your life upside down?
Well, I guess it just busted my belief system, you know, right off the bat. You know, I mean, I grew up a strict Catholic boy, went to church the whole bit, and right up until the time I went to the service, you know, I was going to church. And then I was kind of like, wow, well, church never mentioned anything about this. My parents never did. And, I mean, the Air Force says they don't exist. What's going on here, you know? So I felt a little betrayed in that respect, you know. It was like, wow, has everybody been lying to me my whole life? What's going on, you know? But then it seemed like slowly it kind of crept into my consciousness. Wow, nothing really matters anymore. Everything's fake. I've been lied to. I mean, what's going on here? You know, I know what I saw, and what I saw wasn't any craft that I could see any government or any entity owning, you know, not with what it was doing in the sky. So I just kind of slowly gave it a screw the world attitude. And, I just kind of went down a real dark path at that point in my life. I came back to the U.S., couldn't really get a good job. You know, I was working gas stations and this and that. And just, my life was kind of a mess. I was partying a lot. And finally, I was reading some magazines and decided, you know what, I like being a soldier, but obviously I can't do that again. So I'm just going to go do it on my own, and just found a path to do that, and ended up becoming a professional for hire. A couple years later, found myself in a war zone. So, and did that
but
for about
it,
5 years.
It must have been, though, you were looking for something. You had to be. I mean, you left the Army where you thought you were secure, and then to come back to the States and to just bounce around, there had to be something inside of you that was seeking something. Do you have any idea what it was you were looking for?
No, and just to make a correction, it was the Air Force, not the Army. But,
Air Force, oh, sorry, yes.
Yeah, that's right. I just want to make sure that, yeah, we get down the proper content.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know what I was searching for. And you know, it's kind of funny you mention that. When I finally got my act together, when I moved out to California, one of my good friends that I had known out there for about a year or so, he was talking with a friend of mine, which he was in the other room, and I overheard him. And I just remember him very distinctly saying, "Boy, Steve, man, he's got no direction in life." And I didn't. I was just literally floundering, like you said, just looking for some direction, looking for something. I mean, I didn't believe in anything anymore. I didn't believe in the law. I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in anything. I was just done. You know, I was just done with all the rules, all the parameters that were set up in my whole life were just blown out of the water. So I guess I was looking for direction. I was looking for some meaning in life, something that was not a big fat lie. That's all I can really say in that respect. And then I just, like I said, I didn't care anymore. I didn't think the law applied to me. I thought it was all a bunch of BS, and whether it was religious laws or anything, I just said, okay. I mean, it was actually kind of a freeing incident, you know, in that respect, but
uh-huh.
You know, with freedom comes responsibility, and I wasn't real responsible. So I just twisted
the law. Who is at that
age? Yeah. Well, that's the other thing too, you know, and doing that kind of work. I mean, when I wrote this book, I really had to sit down and figure out if I really wanted to bare my soul as much as I felt I needed to. I think I really opened up as much as a human could, as far as, you know, getting it on paper and explaining my situation and where my head was at, you know? And,
yeah. Oh, you did. I think what's so phenomenal about it is that, you know, looking at it in retrospect, it's really clear that you let go of everything as a result of this experience, and then we're looking for something to hold on to, and everything you tried seemed to fall short.
Oh yeah.
You were trained for a certain type of work, and you know, that's what you tried to follow. And I mean, you went, you know, pillar to post here. You went all over the place, and I don't know. It's really a shame there couldn't have been some sort of counseling for you, but I don't think there is any, you know, any place people can go who have seen a UFO and you know, help me figure out what this has done to my life, because suddenly everything is different, and I need to find something to hold on to or something to go towards, because
yeah.
Everything else seems so superficial.
Yeah, and it was pretty much the effect of, okay, does everybody think I'm lying or crazy? Because everybody's still saying that this isn't true or real and existing, but I know I saw something, and, you know, mm-hmm. Everything that was going on the base at the time, and people were getting kicked out and reassigned, and, I mean, after my incident, I started noticing more and more what was going on, and I talked to a few of the other people that were involved in the incident, and, I was, you know, especially when I talked with Larry Warren, I think that's chapter 6 of my book, just mm-hmm. listening to his story. And I was like, what do you mean we're getting abducted and getting hit with sodium pentothal and all this? What are you talking about, man? So
mm-hmm.
So I devised a plan to get out of the service, which I had to get out of my contract, which I couldn't. So I literally staged a fake suicide attempt, cut my stomach open, and got out that way on a psych charge. So, which trashed my military career, so I knew I could never go back into service after that. But at the time, I honestly feared for my well-being, because I was getting tailed by some people, and I confronted them. And at that point, I was just like, okay, I don't know what I get into here, but this is not good, and I need to get out of here. I need to bail now. So I did. And
considering your age, I think anybody else would have done the same thing, considering your age at the time, and you weren't even on U.S. soil, it definitely, you know, kind of want to go home.
Well, I'll tell you, if I was on U.S. soil, I'd have gone AWOL. I'd have left. I'd have gone underground and they'd have never seen me again. I mean, honestly, I just couldn't figure out how to get off the base and get back home. I had no money, no passport, no nothing. So, yeah, they had me.
But that's a common thing for people that have seen, for a lot of people who have seen UFOs. It's first I want to go home, and then it's like, okay, what does this mean to me? What, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, you treated it defensively, and it feels to me as though you were fighting a change that went on inside of you, and you chose a way where you could fight in reality.
Yeah, pretty much.
To
yeah.
sort of mirror the fight that was going on inside of you.
Yeah, the external versus internal struggle, but yeah, they kind of mirrored each other. Yeah.
I think on top of everything else, you know, anybody who admits to having seen a UFO, and especially 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, most people, I mean, I was in college, and the kind of stuff I got was, well, how much did you have to drink that night? And, you know, yeah, you know, sure you did. And you know, you have an incident that it was so real in your life, and nobody really believes you.
Yeah.
And,
yep.
And so there is that element of, you know, it's you against the world.
Yeah, and there was also a lot of shame involved, believe it or not, because I just.
Why?
Well, I had uncles that were in World War II that landed on Normandy, and they were in Bastogne, and you know, highly decorated soldiers. My father got the Meritorious Service Award for being in World War II and Vietnam and Korea and all that, and you know, and here I am, I can't even make a full year in the service. You know, I felt pretty bad about myself when I came back. So I jumped into drugs and a bottle for a good solid year when I got back. You know. Like I said, I'm trying to be as honest as I can. I mean, it's in the past, so it doesn't matter. It's 40 years ago, but I mean, uh-huh. you know, I can admit it. But when I went to write this book, like I said, I had to do a lot of soul searching and go, all right, I'm going to put it out there, and the world's going to know exactly what you are. So, I mean, that took a few weeks to actually sit down. You know, I'm not a big partier now, but I took a couple weeks and I said, okay. On this certain day, I'm going to start writing. And it was 3 weeks from the day I had decided, okay, I'm going to, you know, start writing here. And I had 3 weeks of crawling in a bottle and smoking a lot of pot and trying to get my head wrapped around what I was going to do and if I really wanted to do it. And I don't even drink or do drugs anymore, but I did for 3 weeks just to kind of, I don't know, mellow my brain out because it was flying in 100 different directions, you know, so...
thing to put
yeah.
that kind of information out there, not knowing what the reception is going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very
yeah.
brave thing that you did.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But it was mostly just some of the stuff I did, I'm very not proud of, and I don't want to, you know, people go, oh, wow, you know, I've got some friends here like, oh, wow, you were a mercenary, you're a professional soldier. Oh, that's cool. And I'm like, no, I don't want to promote that as being anything good, because it certainly wasn't. You know, I was out waging war in my fellow man, and, you know, besides that, I was working with a lot of drug dealers and, you know, bodyguarding them and moving lots of drugs, and I'm sure there's probably people in their grave because of some of the stuff I've done as far as with drug dealers. You know, I mean, besides war is one thing, you know, going out and shooting and get shot at, you know, at least that's more even keel, uh-huh. I think. But, yeah, just, you know, destroying people's lives through drugs, you know, which just, I guess that all comes around because during this big opioid epidemic, I lost a lot of friends. I mean, the ironworking crew I worked on, just lost a bunch of those guys. And I was flipping houses up here. I lost two of my roofers. I lost my tile guy. I mean, I was going to funerals every couple months. It was getting pretty ridiculous, you know? So
wow.
I guess karma came back and kicked me in the ass there a little bit. But, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know. But I think the important thing is that you recognize it. You recognize the stepping stones that you were on. You recognize the the journey that you've been on, and it's not been an easy one, but you did, at some point you found God, at some point you became a husband and a father. I think the important thing is that you won the battle. It took a heck of a long time, but you won the battle.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, the motivator for me to change was freedom. I've always vowed that I will never go to jail. I just, you know, we got detained one time when we were in Honduras, and it looked like we were going to go do some jail time in some banana jail down there. And I was thinking, nope, ain't gonna happen. I'd rather just run out and grab somebody. The people that were guarding us at the time, I'm just going to rush in and grab a gun and get shot. Forget it. I'll make a run for it. I'd rather die than go to jail and give up my freedom. I value my freedom completely. So I did some bad stuff. Let's put it that way. Got in trouble in Massachusetts and was on the run. And, you know, I was hiding from both the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms at the time. And I got on my motorcycle and drove west out to California. And for 6 days on my motorcycle, just decided, okay, I got to change. And at some point just started praying and just saying, hey, God, you know, I need the white picket fence and the family and enough of this. I tried it. I'm done. I'm sorry. I turned my back on you. And, you know, I was just, you know, it's not like I never... I guess I stopped believing in God, but it was more I turned my back on him, just said, you don't matter anymore because I don't even know if you're real type thing, you know? And my spirituality was nil. I didn't care about humanity or life or anything like that. That meant nothing to me. And then I just finally decided, okay, you know, I don't know. The light bulb went off in my head at some point. And that ride from Massachusetts to California is where I kind of figured I transformed back into the human race, because when I was doing that kind of work, I never considered myself as being human at all with some of the stuff we were doing. And that's one thing I told a friend of mine going in the service. I said, man, when you get over there, I said, man, just go animal, go caveman, because that's the only way you're going to survive. You can't have any emotions or anything. You just got to put it up and just be as ruthless and caveman mentality as you can be, you know? So when I was doing that type of stuff, that's exactly where my mind was at. I was just not thinking emotionally conscious as far as regret or anything like that. I don't know. I was just, I don't know if you'd call it sociopathic in some manner, you know. I just got rid of all that. I mean, it's the only way I can survive in that environment, you know.
At one point in the book, you spoke of seeing a woman on a shore, on a bluff, I think, and she was holding a dead baby trying to nurse it, and you and she locked eyes, and it felt to me that that was really a turnaround point for you.
Oh, yeah, without doubt. I still had to finish that mission, which lasted for another 3 or 4 weeks, though, which was kind of rough. But, yeah, after that, I could expand on that a little if you'd like.
Sure.
Yeah, I was tail gunner, so everybody had gone over this bluff to get down into some dugout canoes that were down on the river, and there was the Coco River, which divided Honduras and Nicaragua over on the east coast, on the Mosquito Coast, and so I was left up top to kind of keep an eye on things to make sure we were going to, you know, even though we were on the Honduran side, the Nicaraguans would come over to our side, we'd go to their side, you know, so there's a lot of border skirmishes. So I was covering everybody's back, and then I saw some movement to my left, and I drew down on it. You know, I aimed at this movement and then realized, oh, it's a female, so I, you know, stopped aiming at her. And but then I saw her with her baby in her arms, and I was like, oh, God, she's over there nursing her baby. Man, that's embarrassing. I didn't mean to do that, you know. And then we locked eyes, and then I just before we locked eyes, I realized that the baby she was trying to suckle was gray, and the arms were just, like, flopping around and the legs, and ugh, I can't get that image out of my head. But and then, yeah, we locked eyes, and, man, this girl's eyes reached down into my soul and just ripped a chunk out. You know, she just blamed me because I was a soldier and her baby's dead because of me and everybody else that's involved in this horrible war from her perspective, you know? And we communicated without ever saying a word. And finally, I was just like, I think actually one of my commanders, you know, called my name and it was time for me to go. And that kind of like broke the stare. But yeah, man, I finally made peace with that ghost. Boy, she really haunted me for a lot of years, you know.
I can imagine.
Yeah, and in talking with my commander, he's like, man, don't let that tear you up, man. He goes, these people want us here. We're here helping them out. They're getting slaughtered. You know that, right? And I'm like, yeah, I know. It's just still, you know, still hurt. So,
sure.
But we did do a lot of good down there, you know. I mean, eventually the Nicaraguans got free elections and all that sort of stuff, and then the government stopped slaughtering them. So I guess that worked out okay. But that was just one victim, and that was just one moment in 5 years of that sort of stuff. So, but I don't know, for some reason that one just really hurt. So,
well, and yeah. You know, I do think that from really that point on, you kept getting little hints of a more spiritual life, of a more spiritual understanding that there was more out there, and that you know, you were basically coming out of a fog instead of going into one, because it felt like that was a time where your consciousness turned around. And you know, everybody has that moment, you know, and it doesn't mean they put a white sheet on and go to the mountaintop and wait for the mothership. It means that suddenly, spiritually, there's a greater opening within them, so that they are putting a greater sense of reason into what's going on, a greater sense of understanding. And you know, it felt to me as though that's where it shifted for you. And you know, where the whole incidents on the Air Force Base started this journey for you, this is a place where it seems to have turned around, where spiritually speaking, and again, it, you know, the shifting consciousness doesn't mean you suddenly are out there standing on a street corner and giving testimony. It means you're looking at your own life, and you are trying to shift it and make it more balanced and make it more holy and make it more adaptable to the kind of society that one would hope we will eventually ascend to, you know, where we are a family of man. And everybody, and that isn't a kumbaya thing. It's a understanding that you know, we're all here for a purpose, and it's a good purpose. And it you know, you when you went to China and discovered you had an affinity for motorcycles and stuff. I mean, you were really following more at that point where your spirit was taking you, instead of trying to fight against, you know, whatever was happening as far as the evolution of your own lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it's kind of weird. I've always struggled with a question, which was just before the incident we just talked about. We were in Nicaragua, and there was a certain point on that mission where I thought, okay, this is it. We're all going to die, because we were like caught out in the open type situation. I was just waiting to get mortared or something, you know. And it was probably the only time, matter of fact, I can tell you, it was the only time I've ever prayed in combat. And I just remember, I didn't even know how to pray at that point. And I just remember the movie Bridge Too Far, and Robert Redford was trying to get across that river going, Hail Mary, full of grace, Hail Mary, full of grace.
Yeah.
And that's what I just fell back on. I was just going through this open area going, man, if we can just make it to this cover, we'll be okay. And I just remember thinking in my head, Hail Mary, full of grace, Hail Mary, full of grace, get me out of this, you know. And then, you know, but while I was praying doing that, and we were still pretty far away from being safe, I had this feeling of calm come over me all of a sudden. And it was like, I don't want to say a voice in my head, but I had this overwhelming feeling that I want to say spoke to me, but it wasn't spoken. I don't know how else to describe it, but I had this feeling of calm come over me. And it was as if somebody was saying, don't worry, it's okay. You're supposed to be here. You'll make it through. You're here for a reason.
Uh-huh.
And I never worried about dying after that at all on any mission ever. I even when I was racing, I never worried about crashing and dying. You know, I got hurt a lot crashing, but I'm not afraid of death or anything anymore. I mean, I've had a couple accidents where I really smashed myself pretty bad and thought I was going to die then, but I wasn't fearful of it. I wasn't fearful of it at all. I mean, even right now, if I knew I was dying, I'd probably be upset because I won't see my grandkids or anything because I don't have any yet. But it's not like, but it's not like I'd be afraid to die because I actually think that there's something on the other side. So, you know, hopefully I've tipped the scales from evil to good, where you know. So.
Well, it feels like you have a knowingness.
And, yeah, I was going to say I'm definitely more spiritually aware. That's for sure.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Yep.
And I think all of us who have been through this kind of a situation, certainly I didn't go through anything like you've been through, but you know, there is that element of a struggle and a trying to find a purpose and trying to understand why, you know, why me? Why you?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, big world, why? What made me different? And it feels like, and I don't know what the answer is. I'd love to know what the answer is, but it's almost as though you were given a gift and you fought it for a while and then you surrendered to it. And then your life started to change. And it doesn't mean that you didn't still struggle, because of course you do. I mean, that's what we're here for. We're here to overcome whatever is put in our way. But I think your story is so profound because you took it to such extremes and you still came out to where you are now, which is such an amazing story.
Yeah, you know, I look back at that and just wonder why I'm still here, because there's a lot of times I really don't think I should have been, you know. I mean, I've been shot and stabbed and, yeah, I don't know. And they've all been not very critical wounds where, I don't know, I guess you just call that luck. I don't know how else you'd reason it. I don't know. When you get in a firefight and stuff, bullets are flying, an inch to the right or the left could kill you or save your life. I mean, it's just all so random, you know. So,
I don't know. I think seeing something like you saw that shook you to your very core opened you up to the potential of something even more. And
yeah.
And did you have to struggle through really tough times and really be confronted with yourself? You may have been fighting with yourself internally. I don't think you. I mean, a lot of the stuff you did was, you know. Oh, come on, it was tough stuff. But you were also fighting with yourself internally about what direction are you going to go, and ultimately you went in a spiritual direction. And I truly believe that's what happens to anybody that goes through this kind of experience, that while there's a doubting and while there's an anger, you know, why me? Why won't people listen to me? Why won't people believe me? You know, oh my God, you know, and some of the I'm not worthiness too. But you know, those are all big battles because they're not external with bullets. They're internal with fear and doubt and all sorts of stuff. So those are harder battles for sure.
Yeah, and you're right. And I can take it to. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt
you.
No,
go ahead. No, it's your interview, for Pete's sake.
I didn't want to break your train of thought there. My struggle took me down a certain path, and I took it to an extreme, but that was my own decision. You know, everything I did was my own doing. You know, I can't blame anybody for anything that happened because it was my own decisions. You know, I'm a grown man here, and I made decisions, right or wrong, good or bad, I made them. So I got to live with that. But I think some people, you know, some people may crawl into a bottle or do drugs or fall into depression maybe or this and that. But it's, I think that's like the initial shock of it. And then it's what you do with that. You know, do you pull yourself out? Do you keep going further down that rabbit hole into depression or whatever state of mind you're in? But it definitely changes you. I mean, I can't see Everybody I know that was involved with that incident, it changed their life profoundly in one way or another, whether good, bad, or indifferent. I know anybody that came out of that the same way they went into it, you know? So, I mean, if you look at Larry Warren, look at Jim Peniston and all these guys, I mean, they've all had some serious struggles in their life, you know?
Absolutely.
So, you know?
But that's the thing. That's what makes you so unique. And anybody who has this kind of experience, almost everyone goes through this kind of a challenge and a battle and a wrestling, because all of a sudden, everything that you believed in, everything that you thought was carved in stone, turns to dust. And you are forced to look for something else inside of you to build your life back up on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true.
And everyone, you know, we're all different, so we all do it, you know, in different ways. And at this point of time in my life, mine was like 55 years ago, yours was only 40 years ago. You do get to a point where there is a sense of unbelievable knowingness and peace. And does that mean you're not struggling still? Hell no. But it means that you have a different foundation that you're working from. So in a way, as painful as it was and as long as it took you, it was a gift.
Yeah. I talked with Paula Harris, the one that did my forward, and we had talked about that of, hey, you know, you can look at it. You know, I've always been a big proponent of life as a matter of perspective and how you look at things, you know, through my 40 years of growth since then, you know. But yeah, I look at it. I mean, do you look at it in a negative way, a positive way? And you know, I got to thank Paula for that, because she's like, hey, Steve, you know, this might have been a big negative at the time, but look where you're at and how it changed you. And did it change you into a better person, a worse person? What kind of person would you have been if you didn't see it versus what you are? And I'm real happy with where I am right now. You know, I got two great kids, and as far as my spiritual consciousness and stuff like that, I mean, my mom says I'm helpful to a point, to a fault. I'm sorry. She says I'm helpful to a fault, because I'll give somebody the shirt off my back if they're cold, you know, and not even think twice about it. You know, I told my mom, I hope when I die I'm penniless, and I hope I've given all my money away and helped other people, because I can't take away what good is it, you know. I actually, you know, from going to a person whose God was dead presidents and green paper, I mean, that used to be my life. That's all I wanted was money, money, money. I mean, it's very mercenary mentality. I can't stand money right at this point in my life. You get up money to live and all, but that's all I care about is pay the bills, and that's it. I mean, I don't care about ever getting rich or that. I'm just so opposite of that at this point, you know. And I just generally, you know, try to help people out and be a good person, and you know, try to keep my spirit on a good scale. You know?
Well, considering where you came from, I mean, you know, your childhood and all of that, if it hadn't been for this incident, heaven knows where you might have ended up. But I would bet money you would not be the person you are today.
Oh, no.
Because,
no, I know it.
Because,
I wouldn't have been.
You know, seeing something that shatters your belief system is a very profound thing, and I found that people who were standing next to me either didn't see the same thing I did or were terrified, and yeah, I wish that there could have been follow-up on all of them as well as me, because for me, it sent me into the spiritual stuff totally, absolutely. It was like, okay, there's got to be something else. There's got to be something beyond all this. If what I have now believed into this point isn't the end all, what more is there? And let me find out about it and let me go into it. And you know, you are such a great example of how terrifying it can be and how brave you were to have fought your way through it, both physically and emotionally, and come out to where you are today. That's an amazing journey.
Well, I'll tell you, the hardest part of that journey is the loneliness of it all. Because I don't know how anybody else felt, but I know I felt like, even though there were other people that were involved in stuff, I felt like I was on my own path. And I don't know. It was just like so lonely. It was like, does everybody else feel the same way I do? Are they going through this? I mean, is everybody else confused? I mean, it was kind of like, I see everybody else that was involved with this, and they seem like they're carrying on okay. I know now that they weren't, but at the time, you know, everybody's got their two sides, you know, the side they show in public and then their internal side, you know. And I was looking at everybody else going, oh, everybody else seems like they're doing okay. How come I'm having so much trouble with this? You know, starting to question my own sanity at some point there, you know. It's like, and then again, you know, your own family members, you know, I talked to my mom and dad about it briefly, but I never really explained it to them, and they didn't understand, and they didn't really want to know. They just know, okay, you got booted out of the service, you did something stupid, so let's just move forward from here. But it's like, okay, I can't really sit down and talk to you about this. You wouldn't even understand, you know, which I guess, honestly, it's kind of like somebody coming out of combat and coming back home, like a Vietnam veteran, for instance. I know a lot of Vietnam veterans, and they're same thing. They'd come back, and how do you explain what you just went through? Nobody would understand that, you know? So,
but could you have articulated it, though?
I don't think at the time, no, because I just rejected it so much and didn't want anything to do with it that I didn't even want to articulate it, you know?
And, you know, as you went through life, though, as I said before, you know, your external and internal battles were the same. And yeah, you fought amazingly well through the whole thing, and to come to a realization that there was something more, and you struggled. So and you're so articulate in the book, you know, explaining. You know, you're very honest. You're frighteningly honest on how you felt and what you did, and I just think that the it triggered you into an epiphany of understanding of a greater spiritual awareness or oneness or whatever that's out there. And it made you such a better person. It's in many ways, though it took longer, this is what happens with people who have near-death experiences, and you certainly have had a number of those. It's you come face to face with the other side. And you know, I'm not saying what you saw had a religious connotation at all, because it didn't. But it had an awareness connotation to it that stretched you into places that you didn't even know existed, and therefore you fought the realization of where you were going.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, it changed my whole perspective on life, the world, everything. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't even know what
absolutely.
Else to say about that. Yeah.
No, so out of curiosity now, okay, you've written the book and the book is going to be out there. How does this change you as far as how you approach life? How does it change you as far as how you work with your children? How does it really, at this point in time, how does it make your life richer and better?
I think just the fact that I got it out of my consciousness and put it out there, and it's just kind of a cleansing thing, you know? And
absolutely.
I've just had it so bottled up inside me for 40 years, you know, that... And, you know, I've watched everybody else do the whole dog and pony show with UFO conferences and this and that, and writing books and going from one UFO researcher to another and all this sort of stuff. And I wanted nothing to do with any of that. And so I never really wanted to write a book or be in the public eye. And, you know, some of the stuff I was involved with, I certainly didn't want to be in the public eye. So I just kind of rejected it all. But I finally came to terms with, okay, well, And honestly, some of the things that were being said about my fellow airmen at the time, I was like, all right, I need to write a book and set the record straight on a couple things here. Just people doubting whether people were even on base or on that particular night, if they were on duty or, you know, stuff like that. And I just felt compelled to set the story straight from my perspective and let the chips fall where they may, because I'm not going to go do any conferences or anything like that. I'm not going to go do that whole tour, you know. It's just not
me. I think your message is far more spiritual. And I've spoken to two or three people that were present at that time, and there is a wonderful innocence to what they saw and what they felt, and that, and it's kind of like, and what do I do with it now?
Yeah.
And it's a big question, but it feels like you at least, I think that you have a good feeling as to how it impacts your life as you go forward, and how you are a family member and a member of a community and everything else. And I think it's important that people understand that seeing a UFO for real up close, and you'll know if you've actually seen a real one, because you will have these questions. You know, if you just saw something zap across the sky, let's face it, an unidentified flying object, they're all over the place. But something that has a uniqueness to it that is even greater than that, you know, whether it's a flying saucer or whatever it is, if you come up that close to it, if you are stretching your neck and looking up, then you're really seeing something that is not of this world. If you've seen something that is not of this world, then everything comes crashing down.
And actually, I think everybody that writes a book that actually witnessed a UFO, they would probably want to title. They would probably want to title it "Now What?"
Because
I think that's just the feeling you have, is okay, now what do I do with this? You know, what just happened here, and what do I do now? I mean, it's
exactly
like the first thing in your head, you know, what just happened here? So, yeah. We can joke about it now, but at the time, you can't, you know.
Oh, my goodness. And I think it's funny, because a lot of people who have had that kind of experience want to talk about it, because if you can talk it out, you can maybe deal with it a little better. And yet, the reception you get when you talk is not what you'd like.
Oh, yeah. The tinfoil hat. Yeah. Here's your tinfoil hat, Steve. Yeah. UFOs. Okay. Whatever. That's why I just shut up about it, you know? The first time I tried talking to somebody, I was just like, okay, whatever. Never mind. You know? Because people looking at you like, okay, whatever. Yeah. You got out on what kind of charge there? A little kooky charge? Or, you know, people start doubting your sanity and stuff. So, I mean, because you shut down. But, you know, I wish there was actually an organization, or, you know, like nationwide or even worldwide, where, like, maybe MUFON could have a subchapter of, hey, if you saw a UFO, call in and we get counselors that can talk to you or something about it. Because there's no place for anybody to go. Where do you go and say, hey, I saw a UFO, what do I do about it? People just, again, look at you like you're a nut. So, you know, it'd be nice if there was some sort of organization or some vehicle where people could say, hey, I just saw this. I'm really struggling with, you know, what do I do now, you know? You know,
gosh,
maybe call it the Now. Call it the Now What Society, you know?
Well, you know, you're still old enough that you could form something like that.
Yeah, I probably could, except I got a little different path going on in my life here. I'm kind of going off grid here in a little bit, and like getting off the internet. I mean, I've got like solar panels and stuff, and I'm literally getting off the grid. I don't even know.
Well,
I haven't owned a TV in 5 years. I mean,
what you suggested is a great question, and I hope somebody picks up on it, because it is an area where there is such inner conflict that goes on inside of one when you've had this kind of experience. A lot of people do different things with it. Lynn Katai has done an amazing thing with her Phoenix Lights material and her experiences, and it changed her life amazingly. And, you know, more and more you're seeing people that have had this experience and have gone to, okay, and they don't call it spiritual or religious, but they get out there with the material in a way that people can say, wow, and where did it take you? And I like where you are now. How do I get there? If I, you know, don't happen to see a UFO, how can I get to where you are? And again, it's a dialogue that's important that it take place. And I, you know, you might be, you know, some sort of support system someplace. But I do believe that you will find that people are looking for exactly what you just talked about. And it sounds like it's a phenomenal thing to start. And it has to be organized by people that have gone through an experience like you have. In order to have the greatest validity, because otherwise you'll get a whole bunch of people that saw something streak across the sky, and it could have been a weather balloon, it could have been any number of things. I mean, people that in 47 saw the crash that took place out in New Mexico. I mean, what happened to them? And if you talk to any of them, you'll find that they went through the same sort of experience. This is something real.
And that's the part that I think people need to understand is, hey, the other people went through this, and they're struggling the same way you are, you know? So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, your way of finding wholeness and everything is very different than mine was or than anybody else's, so that the journey is individual. But being supported in your journey, wherever it takes you, is important. And for people to not ridicule and not tease, it makes it all the harder. And you're right. There is a loneliness that is involved here that is profound. It echoes.
Yeah. And I was going to say, that's why I had so much respect for Bud Hopkins, because he was at least talking to people and about their experiences. You know, he dealt with more like abductees, but but at least he was out there talking to them and trying to help them out and, you know, move in that direction at least, you know. I think he helped a lot of people out, honestly, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, what you've put out there is a wonderful story, and people should pay attention to it and understand that your battles were internal and external, that you did find a light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, and that you're continuing to follow it, you know, wherever it takes you. But your perspective is different, and you're a different person, and probably a much better person than you would have been had you not seen it.
Yeah, I guess in the long run, yeah, I could see that. But I think mostly, I don't know, I guess if I had to say anything, I kind of wrapped it up in my book that way too, is just, you know, trying to be inspirational towards people. Hey, you know, this happened, but it doesn't have to ruin you, and you can use it as a vehicle, again, perspective, use it as a vehicle to open up your consciousness a little bit and explore a little more what's going on out there in the world, you know? And, I don't know, start your journey, you know?
Yeah. Well, our time is up, but I would like very much if, you know, down the line, a year, two, three, whatever, I would love to get you back on and just see where you are and what's going on in your life, if that's okay with you.
Sure. It might be a little hard to contact. But
you'd be surprised.
I'll always have an email address, and you have that, so you can always get in touch with me there.
I will. I want to thank you so much. I know this is material that's tough to share, and you've done it beautifully in your book, and I thank you so much for coming on Nightlight and talking to me about everything. So I appreciate very much your taking your time to share with us.
Well, you're very welcome. I appreciate the invite.
Okay, thanks a lot. And everybody, this will be up on YouTube and on Rumble by tomorrow. And if you enjoyed it, please share, subscribe, let us know you were listening. Good night, everybody.